This, a session called "A Harsh Wilderness Out There?" Question mark. What I think is amazing about being with people and talking to people sort of like this, it happens to me every every Sunday morning when I preach, is the amazing reciprocity that I feel coming back from you. Reciprocity means back and forth. A sense of energy, especially in a place like this. I was telling folks this afternoon at the introduction that this is a subject that's really close to my heart, and it makes it very difficult for me to say much about it at all without feeling like I'm going to get silly, say foolish things. And I was really grateful for Marie preceding me tonight, talking about her experience, because she makes it so simple to simply talk about the beauty of what she saw and how deeply it touched her, with no doubt whatsoever that it was a sign of the presence of God. That's what's wonderful about being in a community, is that you're constantly hearing echoes of things that you're thinking about, and learning new ways of articulating things, and also gaining confidence from other people as they join with you, actually, in the wonderful celebration of articulating thoughts and playing with ideas. I feel like this creation, I feel like it's really an appropriate thing for us to be doing this weekend, this idea of meeting God in the wilderness, especially for Holden, since Holden just hosted a conference about a month ago on creation spirituality, a two-week thing, which was apparently very exciting. So I feel a little humbled by that, because I feel like all of you are experts, and coming in, traveling, itinerant, thinking about these things just off the top of my head. But it's really a joyful thing for me to be here and give thanks to all of you. I'd really like to start with a prayer, even though we just prayed. Lord, open now our hearts to you, so that while we think about meeting you in the wilderness, we realize that we talk to you in the second person and not as a third person, distant God. You have come to meet us and to share our struggles and our longings. So now we ask you to be among us this night as we think about the wilderness, whether it is a harsh wilderness or a gentle one, and how it is that you have come to us in the creation and reveal yourself to us. Be among us now and open our hearts, that we may be glad in all the things you have done for us. In Jesus' name, amen. So I think we have before us a fairly complex issue this weekend, and I hope we can make it simple, sort of like Marie made the Vespers simple. Jackie did this wonderful thing, asked me if I'd lead a wilderness spirituality retreat, and then called it Meeting God in the Wilderness. And it's a wonderful thing to do, because it sort of makes it so much less abstract and more concrete. Can we, in fact, meet God in the wilderness? Can we meet God anywhere? I take that meeting God idea to mean something about what we'd call today spirituality, I suppose. Most people would understand spirituality to be some kind of connection with the Spirit of God. I think we feel safer talking about the Spirit of God because it's less defined and less harsh or distant than God the Father. And of course, meeting Jesus is another. We, for some reason, we don't call it Jesusality. We call it spirituality. And I'd like to look at spirituality a little bit, though I know it's hard to talk about these things because the heart, deepest feelings of our lives are involved when we're talking about spirituality, our spiritual lives, our deep longings and our searchings, sadnesses, our lonelinesses, those things that have torn us apart in the past or threatened even our life. But there are also the ecstasies, the beauties, the celebrations, the memories of times of great connection and great hope, of joy and grace beyond our imagining, beyond our words. I think we're going to be touching on a number of issues, and the kinds of issues, the kinds of realities that we're going to be thinking about have to do with ourselves, our communities, our traditions, the world around us, and also that which we cannot name, which is God beyond us. And I have those kind of represented here as five categories. When I was talking to Bob this afternoon, Bob the teacher, are you around? There you are. I don't know your last name.
Stivers.
Bob Stivers. He suggested that instead of a line, it's really concentric circles where in the first circle is the self, and then around the self is society. Beyond society is the larger idea of society is culture. That is, it's a society through time, or a series of societies, or sort of how society has a deeper consistency, collection of societies, if you will. So that's culture. Beyond that, we were thinking about ecology or nature, because in a sense, nature is never, it is beyond every society. There is no society and culture that have not had to come to terms with death, had to come to terms with birth, time, the seasons, if the culture is in a seasonal place. Those kinds of biological or natural things are larger than every culture and challenge every culture to make some sense out of them. And then, because I believe in God and because I'm leading a retreat on meeting God in the wilderness, beyond that is God, I believe. That which is we don't even see as natural out there, but is beyond nature. God, who is so great that nature could be created by God, and all of this given a foundation, natural foundation, so that the rest can develop. All of these things, it seems to me, are critical to be thinking about when we're trying to think about meeting God in the wilderness, especially because it's my concept that God is over here and self is well distanced from God. Or if you look at it as a circle, as Bob and I were thinking of it, self is way on the interior of a group of circles. There's a mediated, we have a mediated relationship between us and God, which I suppose we could spend years thinking about and never quite get to the bottom of. I find it to be very fascinating. So that, you know, in here you have your experiences, your convictions, your emotions, your history gathered around yourself. They're just yours. They're nobody else's. They're just yours. Your own Sunday school teaching or your own punishing priest in, you know, if you went to a Catholic school, or, you know, those are yours and only yours. And then beyond that, we have society, what happened to you as a child or what's happening to you right now in your particular community. Holden Village is a society of sorts. What's going on in your society affects how you see things and can either make it easier for you or more difficult for you to understand, to experience the presence of God. And then as you go further, a culture would be like the Lutheran Church, you know, or an institution, America, something bigger than the immediate present thing, something that has a largeness and institutionality to it, which has given you some of its own framework and viewpoint. In fact, in some sense, a society would be our weekend community here because it really is affecting us for this weekend. But beyond that would be the ideas and the theories that I'm going to be talking about because they come from a cultural niveau. They're historical. They have greater, they're larger than this particular community. We didn't cook them up, and they're not going to die when we leave here. And then outside of us this weekend, we have the world. And that's part of what's so fascinating is that it is the furthest thing out that we can actually see. I mean, it's almost like when you stand on a mountain, you can only see maybe 50 miles on a certain day. And the furthest thing out that you can see is, for us at any given time, we can in fact touch nature. I mean, we can experience our biology, but the other, God, the unnameable, there's a kind of otherness about it. There's a way in which when Marie says, I experience God, you can say to her, come on, Marie, it was a sunset, you know? That was just a sunset. It happens every day. It was a pretty sunset. And, you know, that's the whole struggle with religion is that one person will say Jesus Christ was raised from the dead, the other one will say show me proof, give me some proof. So but nature we can prove. It's out there and it's not inside of us, it's not an idea within us. It challenges us with its otherness. Meeting God in the wilderness is curious and for another reason, because it's a very modern concept. In the past, how would you have completed, I mean, maybe 30, 50 years ago, meeting God, what would be the proper predicate to meeting God? Where would you meet God? In the church. Meeting God in the church. Right? Meeting God in the Holy Eucharist. Meeting God in confession with the priest. You know, meeting God in some kind of structure which the church, which knows about these things, has taught and given to you. Meeting God in the small catechism. I mean, you can just think of all of the possible retreat titles we could have had 50 years ago. Not probably, however, meeting God in the wilderness. It's a very modern concept. The church is there to help people to know God. Or if the church isn't working, if the church isn't helping you to find God, if the sisters in the Catholic school aren't helping you to have a deeper appreciation for God, then as an adult Catholic, you decide, well, I don't want to go to that church. Or if, you know, Lutheran theology is too patriarchal or really exclusive for you, or too Swedish or German, then you leave that church. If you're an American, that's what we Americans do today. If we don't like what's going on in a given church, we go someplace where we can meet God. So if you're a Lutheran, maybe you become a Baptist. If you're a Baptist, you become a Presbyterian. Or for many people, you just leave the church altogether because there really isn't that much of a consensus today that God is in the church, or that the people in the churches have any insight into who God is. It's fascinating time and place that we find ourselves in. So people have stopped looking for or even talking about God in the church. So there's less and less of a sense of even meeting God being a possibility. So the fact that you came to a retreat like this is a fascinating thing. And it's fascinating to think of the ideas that you have. Can we meet God this weekend? Can we discover something about God that will be helpful, that will be transforming for us? It's also a strange concept because in the past, nature and wilderness were not thought of as benign at all. I mean, if you met anything in the wilderness, it wouldn't have been God. When you were in the wilderness, you would meet wild beasts, starvation perhaps, robbing bands, dangers of being lost. You all know the stories of, I'm from the East, so I don't know the name of this pass, Donner Pass, where everybody died, they ate each other and stuff like that. These things happened when people came west, in America even, and I guess it's 100 years ago, isn't it? That these sort of, and when planes crash in the winter time, I think there was one of those too, where people really ended up reverting to cannibalism to survive. The wilderness, very powerful, frightening thing in the past. For the most part, none of us have had to face those kinds of horrible, difficult conditions or decisions in our lives. I found something about life in the Middle Ages, and Middle Ages is where Lutheran theology and a lot of the church's theology about nature was formed. Life in the Middle Ages in the West, meaning Europe, was stark. It was an age of anxiety. Life sustaining natural resources, particularly through the long winters, were generally scarce. And that's even in our time. I mean, the Irish came to America because they were all dying because the potatoes, the potato crop failed. With low population, scattered settlements, and impenetrable forests, Europe was not a place which easily gave rise to the notion that the environment was kind or friendly or an object of wonder or beauty. And as I was saying this afternoon, take away the modern technology of Holden, take away chainsaws and take away heaters and take away all of the stuff that makes life easy here, and we'd have a hard existence up here all by ourselves, and it wouldn't be fun. I mean, we would, it would be a lot of work just to keep this thing going. If you didn't have a generator, for example, those kinds of things. So the idea of nature back then was really in sync with people's experience. It wasn't like they were prejudiced against nature or they were like dense. I mean, it was part of their experience that the people died because of nature, that they were uncomfortable because of nature. If the snow came and fell hard, people got lost on the way and never came back. Now, the idea of nature fared a little better, apparently, in more temperate climates, temperate Christian places like Italy and the Mediterranean, because you just didn't have this experience of nature's devastation quite as omnipresent. Every December, you're afraid you might not make it through. But in general, people didn't step back to appreciate wilderness then or now until they're safe from its changes and chances. Until they have, frankly, tamed it somewhat. It's an interesting thing that, in a sense, wilderness really is frightening, dangerous, until you tame it, until you get a handle on it, until you can sort of secure your existence so you're not worried about dying or worried about freezing or something like that. Yeah, as I said this afternoon, if we were up on Cloudy Pass tonight, right now, if all of us were suddenly transported to Cloudy Pass wearing what we're wearing, we would not this evening notice the beauty of the moon rising, the quiet of the valley, the waterfall in the distance, the
the wonder of the owls in the trees, we would be scared for our lives. We may or may not make it down here. The avalanche thing, that was frightening. Nature is like that in its deepest, most profound sense. So that's part of what's interesting about this meeting God in the wilderness. Nature really does have that harder edge that sometimes we forget about. And so when we sit here and say, why have we done to nature what we've done? Part of it is because of fear, because of a desire to preserve ourselves. We sort of let ourselves run away with that principle, I think. But indeed, the original principle, I think, was one that most of us would fall back on if we were forced into that kind of a situation again. Now, to gain a deeper understanding of the possibilities for meeting God in the wilderness, I think it would be helpful to look more closely at the development of religion's view of the land. From primitive peoples who lived on the land to today, when religion seems to have almost little or no impact on the world. And that's really a world apart from primitive people to a time when we can afford to have no religion. Many people really don't believe in God, or they believe in God when they're in one context, but in another it doesn't work. Now, from anthropologists, it turns out that the consensus is pretty clear. Religion is a concept that is very new in the world of ideas. It comes from a period when people have been doing comparative studies of religions, a period when people had begun to stop killing each other over issues of truth and heresy. Well, that's relatively recently. I mean, holy wars were still going on in this 18th century. The Inquisitions. I don't know when the last... Well, I mean, there is no last holy war. People are always killing people over the idea that we have the truth and you are wrong and therefore abandoned by God, therefore we have the right to take your land or take your whatever or even kill you because we are right. Now, the people who are saying we are right are beyond religion. They're in you can't talk to those people about their religion, because to talk to them about their religion would be to relativize the claim that they're making. They're saying that they have the truth, you know? And you can only kill somebody, or you can only subjugate somebody when you believe that you have the truth and that the other person doesn't. The idea of religion certainly was not common in the world before the 18th century, the middle of the 1700s. This seems sort of basic to us because we've lived in a world which has relativized religion. If I say to you, so what religion are you? The idea is that whatever you answer, you have a right to answer that, and you might be on track of the truth. Whereas if I really believe that only Lutheranism is in touch or only Christianity is in touch, I wouldn't really ask you what religion are you. I'd ask you, are you saved? Now, are you saved? Not what religion are you, because it doesn't matter what religion you are. It's not, what matters is if you're a Christian. I might say, are you a Christian? But much more interesting to say, have you been born again? You know. So people who are able to say that sort of thing don't have this idea that there are many roads to truth, but rather that there is one road to truth. Those are the people who really believe in truth or ideology as opposed to, say, religion. Religion is really a new concept. And in fact, if you think about it, early people and early tribes had their beliefs totally integrated into their lives. And since these early peoples, I'm talking about primitive folk, Native Americans, for example, not primitive in the sense of less than us, but old, have a sense of integration in their belief systems, so that how they farm is a form of worship, how they do their families is a form of honoring God, how they sing is also, or worship is also simply, it's not, they don't draw lines, you know? There's an integrity to what they do. And those are the kind of people who indeed would fight about that kind of thing, because they believe that they, in fact, many Native Americans call themselves by name, the people. You know that. The people. We are the people. Say, who are you? We are the people. So they're not only claiming that their religion is the only one, they wouldn't call it religion, their way of being, but they're claiming that they are the people. You know, and so some other people show up and say, well, they aren't the people, so therefore they don't have the same level of existence that we do as the people. Early worship or early primitive life did not include prayer to God separate from going out and working or doing anything else. When you how you dance the celebration of fertility, how you plant, how you make love are all interrelated. The actions are all both sacred and mundane. There aren't any separations. To put it another way, there's just no self-consciousness about relationship to the universe, to God. There's no sense that I'm separated from that. Separated from God. There's a sense of unity in that. And so therefore you find in Native American language that there is no word for religion, there's no word for faith, there is no word for that behavior because it's simply part and parcel of living. It would be like trying to separate breathing from living. For us, it's the same concept in some ways. And so they, for them, worship would be the same as living. I don't really know too much about this, and I noticed Bob walked out in the middle, so I must be wrong. In terms of ancient Near Eastern religions, which I think would be fascinating to know about. I know a little bit more about Native Americans. But what kind of relationship to the land the neighbors of the Jews, of the people of Israel, would have had. I really haven't studied that well. Somehow I got through seminary without knowing that. But I do know that the children of Israel, people of Israel, are distinct for having one God as opposed to other Near Eastern cultures having options of many gods. For example, Egypt worshipped Pharaoh, so they worshipped a guy. Always a guy, I suppose. Rome was the same thing. Caesar was God. In Greece, of course, you had many gods. I know that in Canaan, which is the promised land that apparently the Israelites took over, that Canaan worshipped Baal, for the most part, a fertility god, symbolized by a bull. I guess it was a cow. I'm not sure. May have been a female cow. It probably was. Anyway, the golden calf in the Exodus story was a symbol of that Baal worshiping an idol, another god than Yahweh. And later in the history of Israel, there's a test case between the 450 prophets of Baal, you recall, and Elijah, where they have a sacrifice and of a lot of dead cows in the middle, and the prophets of Baal are supposed to try to make it start on fire, and 450 of them try to do it, it doesn't work. Then Elijah's turn comes up, he has them inundated with water a couple of times, and then he prays to God, and fire comes down and takes it up, and he wins over the prophets of Baal. So that was a real struggle for the people of Israel, between that nature god, the fertility god, and Yahweh. Now, there are other aspects of that struggle if you look at the Old Testament, and I didn't do an exhaustive survey of that, but it's real interesting how shot through the Old Testament is with this sort of primitive religion that's really a nature kind of religion, which is the kind of stuff that we're kind of looking for. We're looking for meeting God in the wilderness. It seems almost like the Israelites were trying to expunge this idea of meeting God in the wilderness. They don't want to meet God in nature or in fecundity or in rites of of bringing spring back to the land. What they want to do is have God opposed to that, it seems. For example, God appears on mountaintops, very different from a God who would appear in a valley or a God who would appear as in the crops or something like that, on the mountaintop. You know, really, mountaintops are not places where you grow anything. They're really forbidding kinds of places. So it's not, it's sort of a nature God, but it's a God that's tough and challenging and harsh. The first creation story that we have in the Bible, which is about creating the world in 7 days, it doesn't even come from Israel, it comes from Babylon. It's a Babylonian idea that, that God created the world out of nothing in 7 days. The more Jewish or more Israelite story is the second creation story where God sort of breathes and takes earth in his hands and shapes Adam. So the creation story is a borrowed thing. The story of the flood is present in most other primitive creation myths. So this stuff kind of seeps into Israel. The traditional Old Testament theology has this idea of dichotomy, that the land, the Hebrew ideas of the land are in fact opposed to the more primitive concepts, the sort of Native American concepts, but those that are representative in the ancient Near East, that Israel is trying to discover or posit a God which is not a nature God, but rather a God that is different, a God who is a God of history, a God who's concerned about justice and relationships between people, not a God that's concerned about creating the world, or a God that's propitiated by blood and sacrifice, or a weather god or a female god. The God Yahweh that Israel is, that theology has been talking about in the past 150 years is a God of history. And the Old Testament theologians of the past 100 years would be saying that the central issue in Hebrew scripture is how God has acted in history to save Israel. So a God of history, not of nature. The exodus out of Egypt, the conquest of the promised land, the disobedience and the prophets come and talk to the people, and then exile but eventually return to Jerusalem. That the land then becomes something which is peripheral, it's subjugated, it's used by the people, subdued as it were. It's not a medium through which people experience God. And so here we are talking about meeting God in the wilderness. And it almost seems, if we listen to Old Testament theologians of the past 150 years, that that's exactly what Israel was attempting not to do. They were attempting not to meet God in the wilderness like their neighbors who had these many gods, these nature gods, these feminine gods, these gods of seasons and of times and weathers, but rather the God who is beyond all that, Yahweh. Now, excitingly and happily, this is no longer the case. It's just really, and it's exciting and happy because it's so recent that we've gotten some Old Testament theologians who see it differently, who really have discovered a different kind of Hebrew concept of Yahweh. And so we really live in potentially revolutionary times. I mean, as exciting as maybe Martin Luther discovering grace instead of the sort of hierarchy and tradition of the Roman Catholic Church, a time of great fervor in Old Testament studies. And I've been reading a book by a guy named Santmeier, who discovers a number of prevailing metaphors in the Old Testament Hebrew scriptures that are very different from what we've seen in the past. he talks about the metaphor of ascent on the one hand, which we talked about a second ago, Moses going up to the mountain, this idea of getting above things, of seeing in the distance, of going up to meet God, God who is not in the valleys, God who is not in human experience or in the changes and chances of human life, but the God who is beyond all of that, and the spiritual ascent to that God. It's a kind of wilderness motif, but it's a strange one because, you see, it draws you away from your humanity. It draws you up to God. It sort of makes of your struggles and your needs and even your body itself. It sort of says those things are not important. What's important is to put those behind and go to God. The idea of asceticism in the Catholic tradition, where you beat your body and subdue it, that's a metaphor of ascent. You know, to go up to God by fasting and by struggle, you somehow put behind you your physicality and your lust and all those bad things that are part of nature, biology. Put those behind, and then you ascend to God. It's a kind of, the mountain, of course, is a kind of wilderness, but what Santemeyer finds in the Old Testament is another theme that he is much more intrigued with, which is the motif of the promising journey. The promising journey is much rarer as a myth, as an ancient myth. You have all of these stories about going up to mountains to find God, you know, the Tower of Babel, all that. But the promising journey is a whole different one because peoples generally don't like to leave the place where they are and go to another place. But the Old Testament is filled with these stories of people going from one place to another because God has called them. You know, Abraham going to the promised land because God has called him. And I could just go on and on. We all know about coming up out of Egypt into the promised land. These promising journeys always point to the land, is what Santemeyer says. They always point to a land that God gives as a gift. And the land becomes the place where God's essence is most deeply experienced. God's love and care is experienced in the land that God gives to the people. It's God's land. He doesn't give it to the people for them to take. It's always God's land. But if you look at the people of Israel going through the desert, God provides them with manna from heaven. It's miraculous. God provides them with water from a rock, which is miraculous. But finally, God provides them with a land which makes that manna from heaven and water from the rock constant. And it's the sign of God's nurturing, maternal fecundity. I mean, God's continually bearing gifts out of God's self for the people. That's a wonderful new way of seeing the Old Testament. It's an exciting new way of seeing how God has been operating through time, and it gives us some tools to work with. Santemeyer claims that this new motif, promising journey and the fecundity of God are an ecological motif which has just never been exploited in the past in teaching, in preaching, in understanding what our relationship to the land is. And if in history the people of Christian faith have done bad by the environment, now we have some tools to try to recoup that. I just want to turn briefly to the New Testament because I could talk about another guy named Brueggemann who has a book called The Land, but I'd like to keep moving more quickly, and I've touched on some of his concepts. The New Testament is primarily a story of events and people. It doesn't have that much about land, but I found an idea in Matthew Fox's original blessing, which I'd like to play out for you, because I found it to be very fascinating. It really helped me to see Jesus in a new light as someone who had a deep love for the land. I'd just like to give this to you for you to think about how Jesus was a person living on the earth just as we are, and how his choices of how to live were pointed to God's love through the land. Fox says that what we know of Jesus' preaching has a lot to say about a relationship with the land. Mountains, deserts, peaks, lakes welcomed Jesus for days at a time as he suffered his fame and his loneliness and his beauty and his decision-making in all these sacred temples. His biggest and most innovative decision was the manner in which he chose to preach. He chose the way and the lifestyle of the storyteller, the parable maker, who fashions a new creation out of the holy materials of the only creation we all share in common, the birds, the lilies of the field, the fishes caught, the fig tree in bloom, the sheep versus the goats, the leaven and the bread, the mustard seeds of the world, and the rains that fall on unjust and just alike. His reverence for nature was so great that the creatures of nature were indeed his teachers, his professors, who he recognized instinctively were looking on him with affectionate looks and with truth to tell. And so Fox wants to talk about the blessings of Jesus' own theology, which are sort of culminating in the Beatitudes, blessed are the poor in spirit and whatnot. It's sort of Jesus' own rootedness in the earth, which we frequently don't look at because we're so busy with the ethical teaching or Jesus' struggle with the Pharisees or someone or other. We don't see the rich beauty around Jesus, even in the stories that he tells, how sensitive he was to his own context and how obediently and poetically he brought forth as he taught. In the New Testament, there's also talk of the cosmic Christ. Paul does himself, we could think of Paul as an ecological preacher if we thought of him talking about cosmic Christ who takes everything, the world, and brings it back to God, sort of takes everything that there is and saves it, you know, lifts it up to God. That is another motif which comes up a couple of times in St. Paul, which is worthy of closer inspection. And you know, in Revelations, there's this talk about a new heaven and a new earth, this eschatological vision that indeed in the final times or in the final assessment, God is going to take all of this and redeem it and create a new heaven and a new earth with all the stuff that's presently here. Nothing will be left behind. It's a very wonderful vision. We need these kind of poetic visions in our thinking because we've been so bad in the past in our treatment of nature. I guess what I wanted to say is that the Bible gives us these tools if we interpret it in a more loving way and in a more sensitive way. However, we are also stuck with our tradition, our cultural tradition, which we have to struggle against if we are ever going to have a sense of being able to meet God in the wilderness. The problem, of course, is science and technology and the way in which they've kind of taken over our way of thinking. We no longer think holistically, we no longer think of things as universal, but only we think of them as we can control them and in particular fashion. It probably is a result of the Reformation, because what happened was that when the Reformation came about, the prevailing idea of spirituality being going up to God through asceticism that ascent of the mountain that I was talking about in the Old Testament was also part of the Roman Catholic Church going up to God. Luther turned it around and said, God comes down to us. And there was a great potential there for Lutheran theology to say, God comes down to the whole universe. But he didn't. What he said was, God comes down and saves people. And God is mostly concerned with people. And while the first effects of that were not evident, as time went on, all of us Protestants back in those days started to say, well, I am sanctified by God. God has come down. I'm clear with God. The church, namely the Catholic Church, no longer has control over the whole world. Now I am going to go forth and become an entrepreneur. I'm going to go forth and do what I can to establish myself as an individual in the world. I mean, what happened with the Reformation and the ensuing years, cultural epochs, is that the individual began to emerge as the same time as technological and scientific expertise began to emerge. And Protestant religion took its hands off and said, the world is yours to do with it what you want to. There was no theology of creation at all. There was no preaching about it. There was no poetry about it. I mean, someone pointed out that Martin Luther went to Rome through the Alps very early in his life, and Luther wrote some 26 or 28 volumes of stuff. He must have written a book a day. He never wrote a single thing about this beautiful trip on foot through the Alps. You know, it just somehow there was no sensitivity for that, and the Protestant tradition had no poetry about the world. It simply had a lot of poetry about salvation, a lot of poetry about how God has reached out, a lot of energy given to our relationship to God, but nothing about that which stood behind us, namely the rest of creation, or in which we were ensconced as people. And so that was sort of left behind, and what happened is that industrial technical science gave people the tools to exploit the stuff of creation, and especially, I guess, we as Americans know the story very concretely, that, you know, the Puritans come over, they take the land, they see it as their destiny to take this land and make it theirs. I mean, there was nobody preaching then who said, this is the Lord's land, the Lord theology to stop, or no thinking to stop them from taking over, from building, taking the natural resources that were theirs, making themselves comfortable, and displacing all of the people that were already there. It's one of the tragedies of our tradition. It happens all the time. I mean, it's happening in the Amazon right now. There simply is no poetry. There's no confrontation. There's no singing the song of the dispossessed and the sadness of God as the creation is simply taken over. I guess the rest of the story is pretty clear. I guess where I want to end up is with this chart, which is to say that we're ending up finally at a place where we have no experience of God because of our selling out as a culture, even as religious people, to the ideas of our present age. I just want to trace these here. Here's one of the places where my ideas are probably going to confuse all of us, but we'll see how it goes, and then we'll have a chance to talk a little bit more about whether it's possible to meet God in the wilderness, and this harsh wilderness. Is it a harsh wilderness around us? How is it that through the past hundreds of years, we have been saddled with this idea that the wilderness is something that we struggle against and conquer instead of something that is a place to meet God. Now, I have these five categories across the top. Self is this, how to know what is real. The self tells you what is real. Society tells you what is real or true. Culture, tradition, religion tell you what is real, true, ultimate. Nature of biology, and then the other. And I see this as sort of moving out from the center, moving out from the self to that which is least perceivable or least real, most subject to controversy, I suppose, or subjectivity. Now, as I was talking in the beginning, I was saying that primitive people integrate nature, life, and belief. So primitive people actually exist somewhere in between here, between nature and a sense of God, the Great Spirit, energy, which life energy, which gives life, takes life. I mean, they live right in the midst of it. But as people develop, at least if we look at the Judeo-Christian tradition, there's this movement away from a God of fecundity and of seasons and of harvest to a God of history and justice. A lot of decisions and events in Hebrew scriptures rather than a lot of talk about a God of nature. You're sort of moving away from nature. It's almost as if some people would see the Old Testament as trying to make a clear break with the other nature religions in the Near East. And this idea of an ascent spirituality is part of what happens as you move away from this nature to a cultural mode. Now, I would say that in the last 100 years, we've actually moved away from a sort of culture and tradition-centered mode. Our parents didn't really have a choice about whether they were going to go to church or not, is what I mean. We have a choice. We can go to the Sierra Club on Sundays. We can go to nothing on Sunday. We can have our own friends. We don't have to hang out with the people what we can do is make more choices so that we can choose a different tradition, a different religion, or we can choose to have none and just live in a sort of society or a family away from organization. It's a kind of pluralism. Many people have chosen humanism as a sort of a new tradition. And some people, I just put peace and justice up here because I think some people have chosen to work for causes which have some roots in a cultural tradition, but are really a kind of new way of being. To see yourself as a proponent of a cause as opposed to someone who has been given by your parents or by your tradition an identity. Your identity is now a chosen identity. I believe in ecology, so I'm an ecologist, as opposed to I'm a Lutheran, my parents made me one. As you move over this way, and I think this has also happened, I've seen it in some individuals, some of my own friends, I mean, people burn out, and they end up saying, look, I'm not going to deal with any more of this stuff, I don't want to go to church anymore, I don't want to work for your organization, I just want to, like, spend some time alone. I don't know if that's relatively recent, if it's a recurring thing in society where people just back off and sort of keep to themselves. It's clearly not something that is happening in this particular society or tradition of Holden where people are just saying, I don't want to deal with you. But it is happening out there quite a bit, actually, where people are isolating themselves. And so I would say that this is a tendency in our culture is to move away from culture, tradition, move away even from society. People don't read the newspaper anymore. I don't want to read about that stuff, you know? End up dealing with themselves. Why is that? Now I have 6 reasons why I think this is true, just sort of based on this chart. And I want to go through them quickly. Why do we just want to deal with self and not with the larger issues of meeting God in the wilderness or the other. We want to deal with self because it gives us freedom. We're free if we're in ourselves. Whereas if you're in a community like Holden or in a tradition, there's a community discipline, there are expectations, and you have to sort of conform or give up some of your freedom. Or you could say that in serving the community you have a kind of freedom, but it certainly is more complex than the kind of freedom, raw freedom, that you get from just saying, I'm going to do what I'm going to do, and I don't want to deal with you. Now, over here under the idea of the other, which is that circle way out beyond us, this kind of freedom of obedience, if you talk to a mystic or someone who has attempted to move into that wilderness, that unknown, they would say that as they have come to know the other, they have received a kind of freedom. We'll see that kind of theme as we look at this. There's a kind of mystical energy that's over on the other end of the chart, which you don't have on this end. Another reason why we have so many self-centered people is there's an immediacy to the experience. You experience things in yourself, of yourself. Whereas if you're talking about a culture or a tradition, you're talking about experiences that are mediated. You're talking about stories. Tradition has stories. Your parents will tell you stories about what it means to be Lutheran, or you'll read stories in the Bible. You'll hear stories, you'll read history, things that are one step removed. And, you know, I mean, people would rather watch television. This is TV. This over here is books. And over on the end there, we're talking about mystery, myths, things that are beyond us. I mean, they're even more profound that you can't even quite get them into books. I mean, they can only be myths. Are the true realm of myths is to be told around a fire and to have them scare you or move you penetrate your heart in a way that's unforgettable. So it's much rarer in our culture. This is much more available, this immediacy. Another reason that the self is the center is because you can exercise so much more control. You have more control if you live by yourself than if you live with a spouse or with children, which would be the second category here. If you live in a culture like a church or some kind of other tradition, Holden is a little bit more like that, then you have to go to Vespers every night at 6 o'clock. I mean, you have to... there are certain things that are done. You have to go to church on Sunday, etc. So your control is more in others, in a group sort of decision, and you don't always get your way. Now, as you get close to the other, you find that it's a letting go. There is, in fact, no control. People who have experienced God or the wilderness have this sense of grace, of God being in control, totally in control. And that's very uncanny, somewhat frightening, and you can't guarantee that is going to feel good. As a self, there's a lot of action. You are always busy doing stuff, a lot of works righteousness. What you do is what you get, that kind of thing. Pull yourself up by your own bootstraps, feel in control. Because of all the action. There's medium action here because you got to share things. You got to wait for people. You got to wait for the bus. That's why everybody has a car, because, you know, you can just get in the car and go. Here, public transportation, you got to wait. You got to look at other people. You got to, sometimes you don't get on the bus. You got to stand. So people don't like it. Over here, it's low action. You become a vessel for God, and you wait. People don't like that. I mean, we don't like that today. We really don't like the idea of needing to be dependent on God or things not happening. The people who are going out tomorrow on some solo time, an hour or so, you're not going to like it, because you're going to sit there and it's not going to happen. And you're going to say, well, wait, I came all this distance and here I am, so let's go. I want, that's the thing. I mean, it's low action. You become a vessel. You have to be a vessel. You have to wait for God. Another reason, self is center. There's a lot of talk, self is center. Any of you ever done therapy? Man, you get to talk for a whole hour, and the other person has to listen to you. And you just go on and on and on, and the other person shakes their head, and they make some insights, and you pay them $60. There's a lot of talk if you're self-centered. However, if you're culture-centered or society-centered, you've got to listen, too. And especially if you're culture-centered, you got to listen not only to the people around you, but you got to listen to the wisdom of the ages. It's not only me blabbing here that you got to listen to, but I'm going to pull out the Bible and say, now you got to listen to this, you know? It's even more stuff that you have to listen to. You don't get to talk as much. You're not as self-centered. Over here, there are no words. If you really see God, there are no words. You just listen. There's not much you will be able to say. Finally, self is center. You separate things to know about them. This is science. You separate things. You test things. You pull them apart. If you want to know what a flower is like, you take the pistils and the stamens apart, put it on a board, and you look at it. Whereas if you're looking at the other and the unnameable or God or the wilderness, you can't take anything apart. Dick will tell you this about ecology. You can't do this without affecting that. And in fact, the mystics of like Matthew Fox, creation spirituality, are saying that there is nothing. John Muir has said this too, that even the stars are connected in some way to what happens in the earth. There's this intimate connection. That, all of this stuff over here, I'll tell you, is hard. That stuff over there is hard. It just doesn't come easy. This freedom of obedience, the mystery and the myths of beyond, letting go, low action, becoming a vessel, no words, just listen, and seeing the complexity and the jointness of it all. I mean, it causes pain, it causes longing, it causes sadness, it causes a deep joy, and you can't make it happen. I mean, you can only be open to it. A couple more things. Why this is a problem. There's no grace under selfish center. There's no sense of gift. Where there's, over here, there's a possibility of high grace if you approach God, but there's also the possibility of high fear. That's why it's hard for people to do. Whereas there's no grace here, at least you don't have the fear of not encountering God. I'm saying people don't move in this direction much because of the vulnerability that they feel over there. Here, locked in yourself, you have high anxiety. Here in a culture, you have kind of medium anxiety, you have conformity. You have to conform a little bit, but medium anxiety. Here, you have the possibility of peace when you come into the wilderness or the other. But you also have the possibility of it not working out. And that's why people don't want to do it. Here you have much faith. You need a lot of faith to make it a self-centered life. I'll tell you, you need a lot of faith in yourself. You just need to believe in yourself. When you live in a culture or tradition, you can get by with medium to low faith in yourself. I mean, people will pick you up. They'll carry you along. You know it here at Holden. I mean, that's one of the wonderful things about Holden. You don't always have to be pulling yourself up by your bootstraps. Here, there's total grace, but if you doubt, it gets real scary. What I'm saying is that the other really is an other. There are no guarantees in it. But if we believe that I have faith, I suppose faith has to be faith, and it's not a guarantee, that God will meet us, that meeting God in the wilderness is indeed a possibility because God has promised to us in various ways. See, here's where I'm getting to be like Maria, I'm just sort of like, now I'm telling you, I'm getting silly. There's no proof. I think that what I wanted to point out for you tonight is the difficulty of getting past our self-centeredness as a people, the development over the ages of our self-centeredness, so that you won't be deceived, I guess. It isn't easy.
it's a really profound leap to move from all of the advantages of self at the center to the risks of going into wilderness and approaching God. The payoff is tremendous and very profound. And I believe that we can help each other in this process. And that's why I think this retreat is going to be an important one for all of us. But it's not a simple. You can't just sort of get there by deciding to go there. That's what I have for tonight. Tomorrow I'm going to pick up some themes about experiencing how it is that we come outside of ourselves and come into a place of openness and receptivity from a philosophical and psychological point of view. And also, Dick's going to be talking, I want to talk about mediating factors, because in fact, the hope is not just the leap from here to here, but the mediating situations that we have here of society, culture, and nature can in fact bring us to a deeper experience of the other, so that we can take it in steps. We can move gradually through a community like Holden, a tradition like Christianity, seen through new ecological eyes, nature and biology, which is perceived the way Dick is going to be helping us to really look at the land and experience it as something out there with stories to tell. We can make steps to the experience really is of God taking hold of us. It's God's control. We can move into, which, I mean, I've spent an hour on, and I'm not saying anything more than Marie said, frankly. Because there's a way in which God does grasp you. But I believe that it's through these mediations, and that's what I really want to talk about more tomorrow, is how these mediations work. So, are there any questions or comments? I'm sure people have comments and disagreements or brilliant insights that I failed to pick up on.
I've got a thought. It's going to fall somewhat short of brilliant insight. But to make this transition, for me, we meet God in a church or a worship by achieving a community, a congregation. Think about that. We gather together. We take self, the individual self, sacrifice it to a community, join together to meet God. And I think that's fundamental to why we have churches and why we collect and worship, is to abandon that self-centeredness. And through community collection, and then what happens at that worship, you may or may not get that sense that you met God. I can think of a very specific one that happened for me at Holden 2 summers ago, when we had a week that was specialized in attention to the hearing impaired. And the last Vespers on Saturday night, the hearing impaired and the skilled communicators in signing, Amy Connor, others here in the village, led and sang, as it were, a hymn in signing. And I think I can say that the whole community at Holden, and at that time we're talking maybe 300 people, heard the music, which was in signing, and though we didn't know signing. And I think the community achieved a meeting with God, if you like. All right, then you move it And for me now, I have to personalize it and think of why I believe, yes, you could meet God in wilderness, is that you do a little bit the reverse. I go to wilderness to my high lonesome. And since I believe, and I was taught in my Catholic tradition, that God resides in me, and in terms of the immortal soul, then in fact it's to meet my inner self. And the community that I collect myself in is my place in the ecosystem. And so it isn't just abandoning myself in a place that it's quiet and I can seek the my inner self. It's in fact that I place myself in as a part of the ecosystem, recognize that, read that from the things that I see and feel and smell and touch in the land, and in that sense then meet the God that is within all of us. So, you know, that to me is the spectrum, the transition, if you like, that Jeff represents here.
I had trouble with your assertion that when you go out there on your soul, it's going to be hard. You're not going to like it. Mm-hmm. And I guess maybe because I've had my experiences have been too easy. Mm. But they stem from a sort of a childlike innocence and wonder. Mm-hmm. And they are not hard or difficult. Partly because they've done what you've alluded to in terms of taking care of food, water, and shelter. Mm-hmm. Those don't become hindrances. They're not in the way. But then all of a sudden, it's looking at it or opening up as a child and from a standpoint of complete innocence. Mm-hmm. And then it becomes not hard, but kind of a real religious experience. I kind of hate to bias people in that way. Mm-hmm. I guess I'm
glad to hear that, because I guess I want to I'm doing this thing of trying to cut short any disappointment, because I really don't want people to feel disappointed. For the person who finds it to be hard, I want them to feel like that's
okay.
That's okay. Yeah.
That
they aren't. And I find it more difficult for me as time goes on. I can just be preoccupied, so that it doesn't come easily. I don't let go of the things that I worry about. And so I am not becoming a vessel for some reason. I'm doing all this stuff over here for one reason or another, trying to control things even though I don't want to, or trying to be independent even though I know it's better to be dependent on others.
And what I think what David's talking about is a sense of being open and sensitivity and being receptive. Mm-hmm. And not controlling. Mm-hmm. It doesn't sound, he's being open and saying, when it's happened, it's going to happen. Mm-hmm. You know, he's not trying to control it. He's letting it. Mm-hmm. Control him and come into it.
And being and not being afraid of it not happening. I suppose that's
the key right there.
To just say, well, here I am, and I know that it has in the past, and I'm not going to have expectations or needs about this.
That's how I prepare. Because it doesn't happen quite often.
Mm-hmm. It's a good lead for my session on Read the Lamb, because the first thing I'll ask you to do is to return to being childlike. To see wonder when wonder's in front of you. To not be suspicious, not to place the many value judgments that we gain, you know, throughout our so-called experiences. And the second thing I ask you to do is stop the goods and bads that we apply to nature. Fire is bad. Predators are bad, and Bambi's good. It was interesting, if you listen to the psalm tonight, it talked about a gift to the predator, the prey. And but we cast up goods and bads and value judgments. So the two things I ask you to suspend is value judgments and your adulthood. Be childlike. And you'll learn to read the Lamb much more quickly.
I just comment that in doing that, and it's kind of the other side of what you were saying to some extent, but, and it really comes crashing in on me when you bring in childhood, and that is, though, the harsh side of nature. I mean, to watch the avalanche, or if you've ever seen a person drowned, or to know that nature is not, if we were like you said, 1 mile up tonight in these clothes, left alone, I wouldn't be real confident that I could stand there and nature was going to see me through the morning. So I think that's some of the conflict of the whole meeting God in the wilderness is the two sides of nature that we experience. And I think for me, the image of childhood and going back to that, you know, I really felt both sides of that.
But children are not afraid in nature until we teach them fear. And think about that.
I think it's interesting to talk about even the concept of the two sides of nature. For me, that doesn't click because nature, I mean, if you look at the what you're talking about when you talk about nature, that's all encompassing. There is no two sides to it. There's suffering and death are as much a reality, as much a part of the creation process as new birth and life. So I wonder at that point, is the matter of letting go of the, again, the value judgments.
Well, but there's a value in early death. I mean, for someone to die. I mean, we all. It always shocks us when our friends who are 20 or 30 or something have a fatal disease or something, because it's unnatural. I know it's natural, but it's unnatural, and there's a kind of. I mean, when we see the avalanche, our hearts start to I mean, the avalanche video itself was playing on our fear, and our fear comes from a sense of the unnaturalness of being swept up in something like that and meeting this early death. So I agree with you. I think that we need to be we have to recognize that nature. That God is present in nature as a sort of something that we don't quite understand. Why that person had to die, we don't understand, you know. But it's natural.
A lot has to do with the care of. I mean, an avalanche has a lot of good sides to it, and. And it's just part, I mean, for nature, it's almost more easy for me to see that it's just part of the cycle. I mean, there will be avalanches and then they'll build back up, and there will be earthquakes, and there will be volcanoes and floods. And to embrace that, to be aware of the danger, and I think that's what the avalanche movie talks about, is this doesn't, it might happen, but it doesn't have to happen if you have awareness. And the same way in each of those categories, there's two sides. There's that bad side of, or what we call the bad side of the nature. There's a bad side of culture. There's a bad side of society. And there's certainly a fear of the bad side of ourselves. And another way to look at that is that's just a part of the cycle, and that we can accept that, but also take responsibility and know, just as an avalanche, what we shouldn't do, maybe for ourselves or in society, what signs to look for, not to enhance the the negativity.
See, I like that because it is not the avalanche to fear. It's ignorance of avalanche. Hypothermia is a killer of the unprepared is the title of the really good book that a physician that worked with me when I was on Mount Hood. We developed a lot of new information on hypothermia. Okay, again, the fear is to be unprepared and to be ignorant of the things you need to know, not be fearful of nature. But we teach fear of nature. We teach our children to be afraid of things in the natural world, and certainly in wilderness, and it's so foolish. And, and I take a very different approach. The fear is to be ignorant of nature, to not be able to read the great messages, the great book of nature that's out there to read. That's something to be afraid of.
I was just going to say, it's more along the lines you mentioned people taming nature. And I guess I looked at taming nature and I thought, that's something that, it's not tame. I see it more as, I think people don't respect nature. And I think that when you kind of respect nature, you can see the connectedness between yourself and nature. And I think that, I guess you can talk about respect in a lot of different ways, respect in society, respect in nature, but... And I just think that's some food for thought.
Yeah, it was even more than tame; it was conquest, mm-hmm. and that's why the Indians had so much trouble with the pioneers, is because they were diametrically opposed philosophically. Mm-hmm. And if you study anything about or today, you don't have to go to the past. Go down to the Yakima Reservation, listen to the Yakima Council, and they still have the perception that nature, is what nurtures their life, and it is not owned. And the exact opposite was true of the pioneers and explorers, is that in fact they were there to dominate nature and to utilize the products of nature. It was a utilitarian view of nature. And so they had great difficulties just for that same reason. They had two totally different philosophies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the pioneers would never have thought, I think, of the idea of meeting God in nature.
No.
They'd have a Thanksgiving dinner or something like that to give thanks for the fruit of the earth which they had planted and harvested. But
in fact, they prayed within the wagon circle.
Within the
circle of wagons, which they did for protection from nature,
mm-hmm.
and anything out there.
This is an ill-digested thought, and it's probably going to come out like that. But I've raised three children. I'm probably not much of a romantic when it comes to childhood. And I wonder if for me, I can only speak for myself here, that my model for meeting God in the wilderness is not so much to become childlike. To me, a child is all over in this column, this self column. And okay, you get a young enough child, maybe you're not. Boy, oh boy. A lot of childhood is in that self column. The model for me, my spiritual guide, are the creatures. And the ones that I have known most closely, of course, dogs.
Mm-hmm.
Also cats to a lesser extent. But the creatures are my guide. Maybe I'm just as romantic about them as other people maybe are about childhood. But
mm-hmm.
I don't know. It's just, as I said, no digested thought.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, they definitely would be further down the line. I mean, if they would be totally subject to nature and biology, they'd be as close to the wilderness as much closer to the wilderness than we can get, because we're so
isolated in terms of culture and society and self. I mean, we really are self-conscious beings. It's truly, when we experience a sense of God, we experience it as grace. I mean, you can always tell if somebody's experiencing God or not, because if they come away with a sense of beauty or grace, then you think, yeah, they probably did experience God, you know, and that's because we never think that we've done it on our own, you know, that we've achieved that or something. And I think that's the, it's sort of, there's a sudden taking away of self-consciousness, a sudden blessing, a sudden sense of our presence in, the goodness of our presence in the world, cosmos. And I think if you look at animals, you can imagine that to be their way of being. And I don't think you'd be wrong. Other ideas?
I'm going to get halfway through this and then I think. I'm having trouble now weeding out, and I've had some of those experiences that are near and dear to my heart, of being in nature, in the wilderness, and sort of feeling like I'm one step away from becoming a part of creation, if you know what I mean. No fear of the wilderness, eye contact with a chipmunk, ground squirrel, pika, whatever. Sort of being at the mercy of and blending in with, getting in harmony with tides and winds and weather. And so is blending in and becoming a part of the overall creation, if you will, is that in fact experiencing God? Mm-hmm. Or is the desire to be able to communicate in some way with animals, with the rest of creation, to be able to observe the beauty of creation, the sunset, the alpenglow, mm-hmm. whatever, is that merely being what is experiencing God, and what is experiencing God's creation at a higher level? Mm-hmm. Starts getting fuzzy. Mm-hmm.
Good. Who's got hunches on that?
It's going to be different for everybody.
You think?
Individually, yeah. I think it's a different aspect on everybody's views, experiences. How it happens.
Mm-hmm. So it's profoundly subjective. Someone says that they have felt or experienced God. We are bound because we trust them to believe them.
Right.
How about Oral Roberts in the Tower? We talked about that earlier tonight.
Waiting for us 3 million.
Yeah, God was gonna take him if he didn't get 5 million before the end.
Five, yeah.
I mean, was he was in touch? Was he in touch with God?
Well, you're not saying, I don't think, that even though you can meet God in the wilderness, that excludes other aspects of meeting God.
Right.
I mean, and I think, how can you say? I mean, he obviously seems like a charlatan, but how can you say what he's experiencing?
That's a good question. Are there standards? I mean, do you feel like...
Exactly. Yeah. How can you set the standards? Who can set the standards?
Who can set the standards? Are there any?
If you touched on it, where you just lose all self-consciousness. Grace, I think that's pretty strong.
I would say that's true. That's a good standard. That's
like
a standard.
Child.
That's the standard. And I would say that I would tend to doubt Oral Roberts because it seems a little bit, in my understanding of how God comes to people and tells them the wackiest thing, it seems unwacky for Oral Roberts to say, I need 5 mil or I'm going to die. That's unwacky to me, and so therefore I would tend to say that's... And also he's not terribly humble. I don't know, it just seems too entrepreneurial. But maybe my standards are different from yours. But I do believe... See, I would say that the culture gives us standards. That's why I was doing all of this stuff on the Old Testament. I'm saying that the Old Testament gives us standards and guidelines for seeing how to experience God in the wilderness. It tells us that God gives us, that God gave Israel the land, and that God provided an abundant land for Israel because of God's deep love for Israel. God was a God of fecundity for Israel in the land, and so therefore we can look around for those places and find those places where the same kind of richness and promise is entering our hearts and lives and say, ah, there's a place. There's a place that you know, God is coming to, because, not because I just decided that this was a powerful experience for me, but because it's been a powerful experience for many people. It's a cultural or traditional thing. That's why I'm saying that culture can be a mediation. Even what Dick was saying about teaching. If you teach people about nature, about avalanches or something like that, what you're giving them is the benefit of a tradition. If you cross loose snow, tradition tells us that you might die. So therefore, I give you this, my son, as a sacred tradition. Never cross loose snow, because I love you. You know, it's something that's passed on. Any kind of learning would really be something that would come into that. But I would say that there are standards for telling, for discerning. And I think you're right on one of them, that a person would have a sense of being in profoundly in the present, profoundly taken up in something beyond themselves. So that your sense of self-consciousness saying, is this a religious experience or is this just an experience of nature, would somehow be lifted from you.
It wouldn't matter.
Well, it wouldn't matter, but it wouldn't matter because of some new empowerment that you would get or something. There'd be a sense of grace. And in fact, that sense of grace might come simply by going through a lot of time saying, this is just nature, and then finally you realize just nature is the same. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm.
That's the way I felt, but then I stepped back and I said, oh no, this should have been...
I was going to say, I have trouble with the $5 million thing. I'm not one to judge, but my experiences have been much more on a more basic, lower level, where it's more of an emotional feeling that I really can't describe. It's a warmth that overcomes me, a feeling, a sensation, more than a direct, you need to, you know, raise $5 million. So it's a different wavelength that I'm getting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the only problem I have with it is that for a Christian, I thought that the ultimate experience was to die.
Yeah, and the guy that came up with the $5 million did Oral Roberts a real disservice. Yeah. there's a good movie.
A disservice too.
Movie plot.
I don't see that as a bad choice.
I still have some trouble though with the assertion that you can judge that in other people. I mean, it implies some knowledge of things that I'm not sure that human beings have, and that you can judge someone else's religious experience and stamp it valid or invalid.
But I think you're being asked to judge.
Well,
you're judging it either by giving money or by not giving money to him. If you don't give money to him, you've judged that he wasn't really in touch with God.
That's true. Most people don't.
He's asking you to judge it.
Yeah, that's true.
But are we looking for standards for everyone, or just, you know, for ourselves? I guess for me,
Well, it's not standards to judge another person. I agree with you that that's not the but it's standards for ourselves.
To know,
are we supposed to go out to the wilderness or should we all stay in the circle tomorrow, light the candles, and do a chant? I mean, what are we supposed to do? Where is it that God has appeared? How has God appeared? What kinds of communities or historical situations, or how is it that we know God? You know,
correct me if I'm wrong in understanding you, Jeff, but the standards you're talking about are culturally shaped. And if they're culturally shaped, they are a subjective thing. They aren't something absolute. They aren't. They have no judgment value. To me, the statement, you know, the answer to the question, what is the Tao? You know, what is the way? What is life? Is every bit as much God as what the Bible has to say.
Sure.
In terms of, you know, the answer to that is, it's to chop wood, carry water. If that's where that's as valid a place to experience God as any other.
I would agree with you, and also partly because you're serving my argument, but I'd agree with you anyway. You're serving my argument because that is a tradition. It's not necessarily our tradition, but it is a tradition. Right. I would say that the person who says, I don't want to talk about that crap, is the person who's over here with self as center. The person who's